Well, good morning, TNC family, on this final Sunday in June, where today here we are in part three of our annual summer series centered around authors and their brand new scholarship surrounding biblical theology and a life of spirituality and faith. Just a reminder, the entire book list is still on the website and at the weekend service. So let's jump in now to today's book written by Nijay Gupta. And actually, I want to begin by reading you just a few sentences from the book. Quote, "The first Jesus followers were okay with being different, deviating from the status quo, and following Jesus and his way wherever that went. They were weird, dangerous, and compelling. Not trying to be weird in order to be weird. They were not anti-conformist, and they were not promoting an intentional political or cultural ideology. In fact, as much as possible, they wanted to prove themselves to be respectable, good society members. It was more the case that the person of Christ, the work of the Spirit, and the fundamental dynamics of the gospel changed their orientation toward God, creation, the world, and God's good end, and that is what made Christians seem like aliens from another planet, yet is what ended up changing the planet." Nijay Gupta is currently professor of New Testament at Northern Seminary in Illinois. He has written several books, co-hosts a podcast called Slow Theology. He is known as an expert in Pauline theology and ethics, first century Greco-Roman history, and the role of women in ancient culture. He grew up in a Hindu family in Ohio, and then he came to Christianity as a teenager, after which he went on to get a master's of theology from Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, and then a PhD in philosophy from the University of Durham in England. And his brand new book is called Strange Religion: How the First Christians Were Weird, Dangerous, and Compelling. Strange Religion. Strange because, unlike other religious movements and philosophies of the day, they didn't have a uniform place to meet, a church or a temple. And they didn't have a uniform liturgy in order of service, worship songs, and so on. And they weren't focused on religious rituals, religious clothing, or religious rules in order to please the gods. And strange because, unlike other movements of the day, they weren't trying to compete for cultural dominance through putting Christians in office and changing government policy. And strange, too, because they talked as much about loving neighbors as loving yourself, and they practiced unprecedented financial generosity, treating spiritual family like DNA family. Strange. And strange because they spoke of a man who rose from the dead in the middle of time, whose life and teachings was their map, their guide, and way of life. And strange because they believed you didn't have to hear from a rabbi at a temple or a priest at a shrine or a patriarch of the family or an oracle on a mountain in order to hear from God. Instead, God's voice can speak to ordinary you in kind of like the same way the wind blows. John chapter 3, Jesus said, "The wind blows where it wishes, and you hear the sound of it, but cannot tell where it comes from and where it goes. So is everyone who is born of God's Spirit." Which is why the Desert Father, Brother Lawrence, could write much later in the 17th century, "You can commune with God in the kitchen while washing pots and pans." And it's why, to quote Rosa Parks in her book Quiet Strength, "I felt the Lord on a city bus. On that bus, God did away with all my fear and said it was time for someone to stand up, or in my case, sit down." And why, in the words of world-renowned scientist Francis Collins, "God will meet you in a laboratory dedicated to doing research and mapping the human genome." And why, to paraphrase the thesis of 21st century author Barbara Mahaney in her 2023 publication that we read together last year, God uses birdsong and beehive, dirt and weeds, trees and streams, storms and stars to speak to you. And it's why in our day, TNC, I'll actually hear from folks who say things like, they met God in physics and chemistry and sound waves and music and art, sports and exercise, on a phone call and pickleball while reading or baking or working hard. These are not things you would hear very much living in the world of first century Middle Eastern religious thought. All of this stuff is strange. And in the book, Gupta goes into detail about these and other strange, dangerous, and compelling ways the first Christians lived out their faith in relation to the culture around them. But what I want to do now is I want to think more deeply about just three of the ways that the early Christians were strange, three that I believe are particularly important for us to embrace in our day. And I'm going to call them life philosophies, ways of seeing people and the world present in the first Jesus followers that I believe need to be increasingly present in our lives today. And what I'm going to do after describing them is ask the question of you and me, how are we doing in this area? So, here's number one, first strange life philosophy held by the early Jesus followers. Number one, everybody's welcome. Everybody's welcome. I'm going to read now from page 189, quote, "There's an idea repeated throughout all early Christian literature. With God, there are no favorite people. God does not prefer one ethnicity, class, nation, or gender. There is no first class in the church. Christ is blind to privilege. Favoritism does not exist." Now, this was very strange in that culture because, as a matter of historical fact, favoritism and inequality due to ethnicity or citizenship or gender or finances was the norm. Generally speaking, men ruled over women and children, the rich over the poor. Owners could do whatever they wanted with their slaves, and there were tribes and classes, guilds and cults where some were in and others were out, not on the basis of merit, but on the basis of privilege or even bigotry. And almost nobody believed that it was self-evident that all humans are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But in the strange new Jesus community, anybody who wanted to could come in. No entrance criteria, rich, poor, slave free, those sympathetic to Rome, those radically hating Rome. Tax collectors, fishermen, Jews, Greeks, men, women, children, non-religious folks, religious folks, all welcome. And not only were they welcome, but they were treated as equals, in part because they followed the way of their leader, who one day knelt down, took a basin of water and washed their feet, and said, "The mark of a Jesus follower will be the first shall be last, and whoever wants to be great will be the servant of all." The late social scientist Rodney Stark, longtime professor at Baylor University and the University of Washington, he wrote a book years ago called The Rise of Christianity, how the obscure, marginal Jesus movement became the dominant religious force in the Western world in a few centuries. Very famous book. And to summarize it in two words, how did an obscure, marginal Jesus movement become the dominant religious force in the Western world? Answer, everyone's welcome. And in the book, he quotes Aristides, the ancient Athenian statesman, who wrote, quote, "Any slaves in the empire that surround them, the Christians, they persuade to become Christians because of their love toward the slaves and their embrace without discrimination." And one of the earliest descriptions of the church was written by a politician, a Roman governor, Pliny the Younger. He wrote a letter to the Emperor Trajan. This is not in the New Testament. This is a letter written to somebody who's outside the church. This is an observation about Christians. And Pliny is upset because Christians were not buying sacrifices to offer to Trajan. They're not part of the cult of emperor worship. And so he had two Christians arrested and tortured. They were women and they were slaves, so he could torture them without worrying about any consequences. And over the course of their arrest, he finds out that they were not only welcomed by the Christians, but that they were deaconists, that they held positions of leadership. And so he writes the Emperor Trajan about this problem, and he says, quote, "I have found that many persons of every age, every status, and also of both sexes are at risk of joining the church. This contagion has spread not only to cities, but to villages and farms." The Christians welcome the poor so much that another emperor, Emperor Julian, writes to a Roman priest about 305 AD, quote, "I think that when the poor are overlooked by the priests," and this is the Roman pagan priests, "the impious Galileans," those are the Christians, "the impious Galileans notice how the poor are being overlooked and they devote themselves to benevolence." So Rodney Stark looks at all of this from a science and a modern sociology and a population dispersal perspective, and he concludes that it was this radical inclusivity that was irresistible. Everybody's welcome. And it was strange. And Gupta asks, "Do you and I live in this way of Jesus?" And I was thinking, TNC, how we might evaluate ourselves on this, because sometimes folks think they are inclusive, but they're actually not. So let me suggest one way to self-evaluate on this. It's not the only way, and it's maybe only a starting point, but here it is. Ask yourself, is your friendship circle diverse politically, culturally, ethnically, and so on? Think about the folks you hang out with. And also, is your church or spiritual community diverse politically, culturally, ethnically? Because if not, then maybe, not for sure, but maybe, you're not strange enough, inclusive enough. Which leads to a second life philosophy that Gupta writes about that made the first Christians strange. Number two, they believe that inner transformation is normal. Inner transformation is normal. He writes, "I am struck by the sheer number of times that the early Christian writing talks about the interior life and transformation of the worshiper." And then he lists dozens of examples in the scriptures, including like Ephesians chapter 3, where Paul writes, "I pray that you might be strengthened in your inner being with power through his Spirit, and that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith." Or 2 Peter chapter 3, Peter writes, Grow in grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ." Or Paul in Galatians 5, "The fruit, the growth of life in the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control." In Romans chapter 12, Paul says, "Be transformed by the renewing of your minds." Or Hebrews chapter 6, "Let us leave what's elementary and go on to full maturity." Or I think of Jesus' own emphasis on this inner transformation. Like Luke chapter 6, he says, "A good person brings good things out of the good stored up in their heart. And an evil person brings evil things out of the evil stored up in their heart." And he goes on to say we must target inner transformation. Transformation in the Jesus community was normal. It was expected, and this was sort of a strange philosophy for most religions. Now, this is actually very wonderful news for us, TNC, because partly I think it means that when you feel like your life isn't quite where you want it to be, then you should know, hey, that's actually normal. It's even healthy. I should expect growth. In other words, you are going to feel on the inside that you are not quite where you want to be. Because "I've arrived" will never happen. Instead, you're going to always be moving towards and for and in the direction of something. And then when you get there with your outside circumstances, you're likely to still feel on the inside, "I'm not yet there because I'm still growing." And so I'm just saying, please know that if your life feels unsettled in any way, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're behind or that you're off track, because nobody has it all figured out. And part of the story that I think people tell themselves in their minds that makes them believe I'm not quite keeping up with them is a lie, because they are just as much in the process of transformation as you. And further, the primary goal of the With God life is not to discover a big breakthrough moment, a momentous achievement, and an obvious exit from a past that feels murky, or an entry into a new and more impressive life. Rather, the primary goal of the With God life is, today, I will live with questions and curiosity and attunement to the presence and person of God. And in the process, my heart and mind will be transformed a little bit, and I will move and grow toward being a person of greater love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. This is the hope of transformation, and this is a wonderful thing, because ask the one struggling with body image issues how they would feel to increasingly no longer look in the mirror and feel too round, too thin, too tall, too short, too pale, too dark, and so on. Ask the man consumed with jealousy how he would feel if he woke up one day to discover that he felt less jealous, or that his jealousy was simply gone. Ask the raging person what it would be like to be free of this anger, or ask the alcoholic what it would be like to be completely free from addiction. See, take the things that you are struggling with and then ask yourself, what would it be like if I never struggled with them again? This is what the first Christians believed was possible and normal, that you can become more like the person you were made to be, because God is doing a work in and through you and me. Now, the question here for us, Gupta would ask, is, do you live in this way of Jesus, where you expect and you anticipate transformation? And I was thinking, TNC, how might we evaluate ourselves on this? Because sometimes folks think they are growing, but they're not. So let me suggest one way to self-evaluate on this. Just ask yourself, how am I different than I was 1 year ago? How am I different than I was 5 years ago? Ask yourself, is there something I have today that my past self would be impressed by or grateful for, even if it feels normal now? Or riskier, maybe more helpful, ask someone else to meet you, someone you trust who's seen you over the years, and ask them to explore these questions with you. Because transformation is normal in the Jesus community, inner transformation. Which leads to a third life philosophy that Gupta writes about that made the first Christians strange. Number three, they lived with great confidence in a future forever with God. They lived with great confidence in a future forever with God. Again, quoting Gupta, he writes, ancient religions, by and large, didn't dwell on the future, certainly not with any kind of specificity. Religion was primarily about maintaining the traditions of worship that had been passed down from ancestors and that ensured the blessing of the gods. Christians, however, were dedicated to promises of God about future vindication and renewal. It was about trusting that God was good and had done good and would continue to do good and had good in store for their ultimate future. It was, I believe Jesus was more than just a wise rabbi with fresh ideas or magical abilities. He was and is a cosmic Christ who holds the past, present, and future in his hands. And so I can live from what might be called this cosmic optimism. Now, TNC, this stands in such major contrast to the way many in our world see our existence, which feels to me like a very pessimistic future perspective. And it's described by like atheistic physicists this way. We and all our lives, contributions, and memories are destined to vanish in the heat death of the universe because the end is coming. It might be 100 billion years from now, but it will come, the time where there will be a final sentient being who will have a last thought, a final moment of consciousness, and that thought or word will then vanish into silence, along with the memory of all humanity. And what remains will be photons drifting for billions and billions and billions of silent years. And some say, well, this should be a relief. The death of the future should free us to concentrate on the magic of the moment. We get to experience life and light for a sliver of eternity, and this is a gift. But for me, the great tragedy of this is, it is just filled with ultimate pessimism. that not only is existence temporary, but that it's meaningless because on that day, when the final sentient being has passed away, none of it will have mattered at all, whether you lived with love or hate, selfishness or selflessness, which means there is not a moral arc of the universe which bends towards justice. And that's just a very pessimistic view, TNC. I just don't hold it. I hold the perspective that the early Jesus followers held. That God is responsible for the universe. That God had the first word on the universe, in the beginning God. And that God will also have the eternal word on the universe. Which means one day there will be a new heavens and a new earth. Revelation 22, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea, an ancient image of chaos, because chaos is utterly defeated, and no longer will there be any curse, and we will see the face of God, and we will reign forever and ever. And the angel said to me, "These words are trustworthy and true." And that's the cosmic optimism that Jesus held and taught. And that's the hope that was held by the early Jesus followers. And that's the invitation I embrace. A relationship with God where everyone's welcome and transformation is normal. And we can live with great confidence in an ultimate future forever with God. Will you pray with me now as we close? God, I pray now for every person listening that they would know that with you and within this TNC community, that they are welcome. And we are all together growing. None of us has arrived, and so there's great grace and welcome in that. And there's also great hope because you are the God of yesterday, today, and forever. And so now I pray, TNC, that God would bless you and keep you. Make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. Turn his face towards you and give you peace. Amen.